Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Today is the day. Welcome to Faith Radio Mornings here on the 28th of December. Merry Christmas. We have been celebrating Christmas all week, even after the fact. And that's an important thing to do because the 12 days of Christmas actually don't start until after Christmas and take us into the events of Epiphany. So if that tree is still up, you are in good company this morning. We're doing our best of shows this week as we look back at 2018 as part of Faith Radio Mornings. And our first interview this morning was actually conducted in June by Neil Staven, program director, and he was talking with John Ashman about the importance of just doing work on behalf of people in need. John Ashman is part of Rescue Missions and does such important work relative to hospitality and caring for some of the basic needs in people. So it's a great start to the show. It's one of the common themes we want to address on Faith Radio Mornings. So welcome to the show for this 28th of December.
Faith Radio Morning, and looking forward to spending some time now talking with John Ashman. John is president of the Association of Gospel Rescue Missions, although we're going to find out right away that they are not changing their focus, but changing their name, and so we'll tell you about that in just a moment. But, you know, if you go back in history, you know, since about the late 1800s, rescue missions have been offering radical hospitality in Jesus' name to people who are dealing with hunger, homelessness, abuse, and addiction. Those problems are still with us, and thankfully there are ministries like the ones that John oversees that are having a great impact. So, John, welcome to Faith Radio Morning.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So let's talk about we thought this would be a good time to talk because your annual convention is coming up in Milwaukee starting Tuesday. But there's more than just a convention going on. You actually have a new name, right?
We are unveiling a new name. It happened on Friday, and the Association of Gospel Rescue Missions, which is a real mouthful, about 13 syllables, will be known as CityGate Network in the days ahead.
And
CityGate Network kind of goes back to Bible times when the city gate was the place where people gathered. You know, Abraham and Lot sat in the city gate, not at the city gate, but in the city gate, which meant it was a large area to welcome the stranger, where people were running, could stop running when they crossed into the threshold of the city gate. It was a place where you could have your immediate needs met. Court was held there. And so we see ourselves as the city gate. A lot of people say, isn't the church the city gate? Well, in many places it is. But, you know, in a lot of high urban areas, churches are padlocked until 10 of 11 on a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And a lot of times people are told you go to that church and the family will never talk to you again. And other people wonder, is the government the city gate? And these days people are saying you go to the government, they'll take your kids away. Or you go to the government and you may be on a plane to back to another country. So we look at all of the ministries that are doing life transformation, which is really what is core in our missions and kindred ministries, and say we are the city gate these days, and we are a network from coast to coast doing that kind of work.
So grateful for the 300-some agencies that are part of this network. But, John, you mentioned City Gate, but I guess we think oftentimes that the work that you're doing are with the people that are in parks and alleys and underpasses and riverbanks. That, I mean, you're since the very beginning, you've been dealing with the homeless and the addicted and the hungry. That hasn't changed, has it?
It hasn't changed, and you know, there really is a bit of a refocusing, even with our name change. And the refocusing is to just concentrate and getting more attention to the third stage of what happens in a mission, or like I'm saying, kindred ministries. There is the rescue aspect, and the rescue aspect is going out and talking to that person who's about ready to shoot up and possibly overdose, and getting them in a van and getting them to the mission. It's intercepting that woman who's running away from a pimp and saying there's room for you in the mission. Those are rescue actions. That is rescue, and that still goes on. Then there comes the stabilization after the person has been in the mission for a while and maybe gone through an addiction recovery program, or if there's mental illness, seen doctors and have had their meds tweaked and seeing a counselor. And after that stabilization period, then comes life transformation, which is really what we're called to do. And life transformation is something like this. I'm under a bridge tonight. It's going to be below freezing. I haven't eaten in 2 days, and those men who want my shoes know where I'm sleeping. Wait, there's the mission van taking me and saying I could get something to eat and have a warm place to sleep. That's rescue. And then the person would say, well, who knows where I go from here because I'm addicted. Wait a minute, now I can get into an addiction recovery program. That's stabilization. And then after that, they can help me get my GED. They can help me with job training. They can help me job placement. They can help me find a place to stay. They can help move my son back in with me. They can put me in a church and surround me with community. That's the life transformation part. That's the longer part. That's the part that we want to measure in the days ahead, that to show what success really is.
You know, speaking of measurements, I mean, I think we all want to know, certainly in terms of maybe government programs, you know, are they effective? But how about, you know, programs, the kinds of ministry that the missions all across the nation are doing? Are they effective? Are they having impact in making life change?
They are. They are having a significant impact. The recidivism rate is very low for those who go through a program at a mission, and some of them even go back and end up working at their missions. But our goal is to get everybody that goes through a mission to end up doing their own missional living, giving back. You know, for so long, missions and other ministries talk about output statistics, you know, how many meals served. You know, I can tell you that our missions serve about 80, 85 million meals a year. We provide about 30 million nights of lodging. You know, those are output statistics. Output measures need. The outcome statistics, you know, how many people who went through an addiction recovery program are clean and sober 2 years later? How many people who made a commitment to change their life and commit to Christ are still in community in a church 2 years later? Those are outcome statistics. Those are the ones that take longer to measure, but that they measure success. So you can measure need or you can measure success. And we're doing more and more to measure success in the days ahead.
You know, we've heard about, growing issues like the opioid epidemic. I mean, addictions of various kinds have always been an issue. It seems like homelessness is growing. Lots of different strategies to try and approach that. Is there an addiction and maybe a mental health connection with just about everyone that comes through your door?
Well, depending on where you are, what city, you know, it's going to be different in some cities, but we generally find that between 30 to 70% of the people, depending again on where you are, 30 to 70% of the people who come to a mission have some form of mental illness. And so that's very significant. There's also addiction, which has to be dealt with. You mentioned about strategies. You know, the government's strategy, and I don't fault it, but it's a strategy culminates in a program called Housing First. And Housing First has saved thousands and thousands of lives. The Housing First is a strategy that says, let's skip all the steps from going to a street, from the street to a shelter, from a shelter to transitional housing, and from transitional housing to permanent supportive housing, and from permanent supporting of housing to your own apartment. Let's just put you in your own apartment right off the street. Like I said, that has saved lives. But we find that so many of those folks don't have the ability to stay in that house. I was with the director of our mission in Omaha a few weeks ago at HUD, Housing and Urban Development in Washington, D.C., and she was talking to the undersecretary with me, and she said, in my city, 67% of the people who go into a housing first house or apartment are back in my mission within a year. And so what we look at is seeing what we're hoping for is seeing housing end, but we are all doing it through the process of life transformation so people can get to the point where they're stable in a house and can stay there.
John Ashman is the president of CityGate Network. It's the new name for the Association of Gospel Rescue Missions, which is a network of some 300 agencies and missions that provide training and resources and support to great outreaches in communities all across the country. And we're going to talk more with John in just a moment here on Faith Radio Morning. And John Ashman with me today. John is the president of formerly it's the Association of Gospel Rescue Missions. They've just announcing a new name to CityGate Network. And it's one of the actually the Association of Gospel Rescue Missions, one of the oldest and largest faith-based charity networks in the United States. These men and women are doing great work as we sometimes don't focus enough on. But I want to, you mentioned that we're talking a little bit before the break about, you know, government strategy to address homelessness. Wondering, are government oversight, is that affecting your work and what you can do? Or what are some of the challenges you're facing as a ministry?
Well, right now we've got some great opportunities ahead of us. Some of the stuff that Secretary Ben Carson at U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development is putting forth are pretty exciting. What we have found is the government's strategy, which we talked about before the break, was housing first, you know, and even rapid rehousing, which is kind of a subset of that. But all of that is based on the premise that the primary cause for homelessness is lack of affordable housing. At all of our missions and Kidron ministries, we say, yes, lack of affordable housing is a problem, but the homelessness also is because there's family dysfunction and mental illness and addiction and a lack of education and lack of job skills. And so that's all part of what we do in missions, you know, the rescue, the stabilization, and the life transformation. Secretary Carson just put forward an initiative called Envision Centers. And brilliantly, he is saying, which, you know, kind of shocks a lot of people, let's stop measuring success by the number of people we get off the street and into government housing. Let's measure success by the number of people we get out of government housing and get into their own homes. And he has based this on four strong pillars, economic empowerment, education and advancement, health and wellness, and character and leadership. And it's got some great opportunities to be implemented over the next years. And we see missions as those organizations that can really get behind the wheel of this.
By the way, you mentioned Ben Carson. I think he's one of the speakers right at your annual convention coming up this week, right?
He is. He's going to be with us in Milwaukee, and he's addressing the group for a period of time, and then he's turning it over to questions, going to do a Q&A, which is very brave.
Yeah.
But he's a great man who's got a wonderful testimony, loves the Lord, and is holding his own in Washington these days.
You know, I know one of the questions maybe that you are faced with sometimes, say, are we compassionate and erring on the side of grace? How do you address some of those maybe critiques?
Well, when we talk about compassion and what people can do, we've never done a good job in the church and throughout Christianity to say, here is the right way to help and here's the wrong way to help. You know, I talk to so many youth leaders who say, hey, we're engaged in helping the homeless, and we go down to the park and take, you know, 40 pizzas down, and all the youth hang around, and they talk to people and say, hey, we're doing this in Jesus' name, and we hope you have a great dinner tonight. And then they leave, and the next night the Methodist church goes down, and the next night the Lutheran church goes down, and the next night the Catholic church goes down. And really what we have done is become poverty pimps. You know, we are think that it's compassion, but we are saying to these people, stay here because we're going to keep feeding you. We are seeing more of our missions take a very different approach. I was just at a mission in Toledo, Cherry Street Mission, and they as soon as you walk through the door, a homeless person or somebody in need, you go up to a desk, you within 90 seconds you have a card that has your photo ID and a bar code on it, and it's top loaded with enough points to get services for a week. So you can go get food, and the food, you can go get coffee and toast, which for 3 points, or you could get coffee, toast, and eggs for 5 points. And you are able to put more points on your card by accessing services. So you go and do an assessment, and you get more points. And then you enroll in a GED class, and you get more points. They've got it where they have several local colleges under their roof training people how to do automotive mechanics, welding, call center response. And for all of these things, you keep getting points. And so the value you are putting into your life is what you are using to pay for your services going forward. And ultimately, that's what is going to happen when you get out. You're going to get money, and you're going to pay for the services. That's intelligently showing compassion in a way that helps people move forward, not keep them stranded in the park waiting for the next delivery of pizzas.
You know, I think a lot of us do have that. We want to be compassionate and caring, and though you've got great missions all across the nation that are doing good work, is there maybe one key area where we could plug in, partner with you that would be most effective, that would help you the most day by day?
Well, yeah, working with the missions, partnering with them, and not just going to serve. You know, a lot of people think about serving at a mission when the holidays come around. You know, you got Thanksgiving and Christmas, and the missions are just inundated with requests to serve turkey and put mashed potatoes on the plate. You know, we would say people eat the third Tuesday in April, too, don't forget. But the idea of going to these missions and getting engaged with the people, you know, it's just wonderful to go and say, hey, I'd like to be a table chaplain. And a table chaplain just goes and gets food as well and sits at the table as people are eating and looks across the table and says, hey, Bruce, where did you start out in life? You know, really? What? And then have you seen your parents since then? You know, well, let me tell you what happened to me, a similar situation. And just engaging and starting to get conversation. Our missions are seeing as many people come to Christ and make a decision to change their life at the dining room table as they are in the chapels. And so there's great opportunities to partner and be table chaplains and be involved in programs and lead studies, not just Bible studies, but studies in economics and in well-being and mental health and in life skills. Those are the kinds of things that missions are wanting to see these days when people say, I want to volunteer.
John, we so appreciate the work that you're doing and the great group that you're leading, the new name now for the Association of Gospel Rescue Missions, Citygate Network. And I know your annual convention, the theme is Walk in Wisdom, and we pray that you and all those who are leading missions would be infused with a fresh dose of wisdom to handle these challenging days ahead.
Thank you so much.
Great interview with Neil Stavem and John Ashman this morning to get things started on our Best of programming, and more to come here for the 28th of December. Up next on Faith Radio Mornings, as part of our best of programming, we'll throw it to the news for just a bit, and then we'll listen to a conversation that I had back in October with Ryan T. Anderson around some important topics related to the LGBT community. Ryan does such a good job talking us through senses of identity, the way people are defining themselves these days, and why that ends up falling short so often when it comes to understanding ourselves. Because if we anchor our identity and our sense of sexuality, it gets pretty tricky because those things can fluid and change throughout the course of a lifetime. So stay tuned for the upcoming segment with Ryan T. Anderson next on Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, and delighted to be joined on the line by Dr. Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation, who does a lot of research work for them. I know you know Heritage if you're listening this morning. We have a number of guests on from that organization do a great job with us on Faith Radio Mornings. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
So you wrote a book recently here titled When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. What sort of prompted you to write this book, Ryan?
Two things, really. First was we were getting all these requests at the Heritage Foundation about the public policy and legal aspects of gender identity and transgender identities in particular. You know, what to do about bathrooms, locker rooms, sports teams, medicine, the military. We were getting a lot of public policy questions. But then the second thing was that as I started digging into some of the public policy debates, I discovered the real human side of this discussion. It's not just a legal discussion, a public policy discussion. And what most captured my thoughts on this were the people who had transitioned, thinking it would bring them wholeness and happiness. And then 5 or 10 or 15 years later, they detransitioned because it hadn't brought them that wholeness and happiness they were looking for. And those stories are really heartbreaking. Those stories are almost never told by the mainstream media. And I thought, you know, I'd written other books. I'd written about marriage. I had written about religious liberty. And I thought, I just need to do what I can to try to help people think about what's going on in this transgender moment that we're living in to prevent other people from experiencing this heartbreak.
Well, and certainly that is something that's starting to make its way into some of the headlines. But to your point, the national narrative is that this is sort of a cure-all, fix-all. If somebody is feeling a bit of dysphoria where their biological sex doesn't match up with their psychological sense of their gender. But we see, and you're going to have to help me with the surgeon out of, I believe it's out of Russia, right, that says that one of the top genital reconstructive surgeons says that sex change regret is on the rise and more patients are coming to him to have their gender confirmation surgeries reversed. And that's an incredibly expensive and difficult procedure.
Yeah, and there's no good data here, right? I mean, so when we hear one of the physicians who engages in this sort of medicine saying, wait a minute, too many people are going through with this, and now they're regretting it, he's striking a cautious note, and he's someone who in general is supportive of reassignment procedures. I mean, what's been fascinating to watch is that the ideology surrounding these issues has been moving so quickly that even doctors who were generally willing to think that you could reassign sex are now saying we've gone way too far because we're blocking puberty in children, we're transitioning children, we're transitioning people without doing appropriate mental health screenings, without doing appropriate counseling, without exhausting other possibilities. And now they're being attacked for being transphobic simply because they want a little bit more caution.
Well, and to that point, what has your research sort of shown in terms of how maybe some of the gender dysphoria sorts itself out over time? I know it's not for everybody, but a lot of times, you know, there's this concern at a very early age of if people are playing with maybe gender toys or dolls that are different than their existing gender, we immediately want to transition them. But it seems like over time, if just let the course of events play out, that gender dysphoria resolves itself.
That is what, according to the DSM-5, so that the handbook for mental health professionals, that's what they report. They report that the best studies show that somewhere around 80 to 95% of young people with a gender identity conflict will naturally grow out of it and will have their gender identity align with their biology if you don't interfere with their development. So if you have a young person who's going through a stage where they don't feel comfortable in their own body, If you just give them the time to continue growing, continue maturing, continue developing, most of the time, 80 to 95% of the time, they'll end up feeling comfortable in their own body with no therapeutic intervention.
Well, and the rise of transgenderism, Ryan, is something that has been relatively recent, and obviously transgenderism has been with us ever since, you know, I've been alive and obviously throughout history, but there seems to be a real significant increase in transgenderism. Is this just because social norms have changed and people feel more freedom to come out as transgender, or are there some social pressures happening? Is the way we talk about gender in our country? What's fueling some of the rise in transgenderism?
So I think it's a combination of technology, ideology, and then power politics. And what I mean by this is that, first, it's only going to be a plausible idea that you could be a man trapped in a woman's body or a woman trapped in a man's body and that modern medicine could reassign your sex if modern medicine now has those technological capabilities, or at least that they could claim to have those technological capabilities. In actual reality, sex reassignment procedures, they don't reassign sex. What they do is they remove certain body parts and then they construct something that resembles the opposite sexes, but they don't turn a man into a woman. So there's a technological part of this. There's also an ideological part of this. This is only plausible in the late stages of the sexual revolution. It's only after 50 years of the sexual revolution and of the 1960s that we arrive at a moment in which we say that consenting adults should do what they want to do with their bodies, and then we extend that principle to even children could change their bodies. Right? It's not just do with your bodies what you want, but actually change bodies. And lastly, there's a power politics move here. It's not surprising that most of the legal and policy changes took place right after Obergefell, Obergefell being the Supreme Court case that redefined marriage. As soon as the activists won on the marriage issue, they pivoted from the LGB part of the acronym to the T part of the acronym. And because at the time that presidential administration was very sympathetic to LGBT activists, they shifted from what they called marriage equality to trans equality without ever really stopping to think, what does this mean? What does this mean for children? What does this mean for women? What does this mean for the body? And that's where we now find ourselves.
We're talking this morning on Faith Radio Mornings with Dr. Ryan Anderson, who's a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and released the book When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. And Ryan, you talked a bit about some policy procedures and some shifts that have happened over the last maybe 6-8 years in our country. And recently, the president, President Trump, has come out and has tried to narrow the definition of sex and gender, specifically saying that sex has to be male or female, that it's not going to be on a continuum. Where do we see this going at this point?
Yeah, I mean, the purpose of that move from the Trump administration is to respond to an unlawful action that the Obama administration did in its last months of office, where it redefined the word sex in our nation's civil rights laws to mean gender identity. And after they did this, they then said to every school that this means you have to allow students to use the bathrooms and locker rooms and showers according to their gender identity, not according to their biology. The Obama administration then said that all healthcare plans would have to cover reassignment procedures, that all relevant physicians would have to perform them. So if you're a surgeon who would perform a double mastectomy in the case of cancer, you'd have to perform it for a woman who wants to identify as a man. The Trump administration is simply saying, no, we're not going along with that. The word sex refers to the biological, anatomical, physiological reality. And while people are free to live how they want to, we're not going to be coercing schools and doctors into violating their beliefs, into violating common sense procedures, common sense practices, whether it's a bathroom policy or a medical policy.
Well, it's fascinating to watch because that was one of the, obviously, points of discussion for many states and many schools, as well as what do we do in terms of who gets a chance to be in what bathroom. It even made its way into some of our retail outlets like Target, and there's a lot of controversy on that. So we're talking with Ryan Anderson here this morning about issues within the transgender movement. We're going to take a short break, and Dr. Anderson, when we come back from break, I would love to get your perspective on some tips for parents, too, you know, in terms of if their children are wondering about this or have questions or maybe are experiencing some some dysphoria themselves, how we can help parents take steps forward with their kids. So more to come with Dr. Ryan Anderson on Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. We're talking this morning with Dr. Ryan Anderson, who released a book this past year that titled When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. And I know, Ryan, we were talking before the break a little bit about some of the policy shifts, or at least the president making it more explicit in terms of how we're going to identify and define gender moving forward. This was a statement that came out from the Department of Health and Human Services, where it says that sex means a person's status as male or female is based on the immutable biological traits identifiable by or before birth. And so there really is the sense where there's wanting to be a narrowing of the definition so that we can figure out life together. And that's part of what you explore in your book as well.
Yeah, I mean, what's important to realize here is that the word sex refers to how an organism is organized with respect to sexual reproduction. The reason why there are two sexes is because there's a male way in which an organism can be organized and a female way in which an organism can be organized. There are two kind of sex sets of chromosomes, XX and XY. There are two sets of sex organs. There are two sets of sex genitals. And there are two sex gametes, sperm and egg. There's no third sex because there's not a third set of sex chromosomes or sex organs or genitals or gametes. This is why there's a stable binary here, male and female. And this is also how we determine sex across the animal kingdom. This isn't just something that we do for humans. This is something that we do across the animal kingdom. And then it's only become controversial with humans when people want to say that their gender identity determines their sex. But that's not what our law says. Our law and our lawmakers have refused to make gender identity a protected class the way that we make race and sex a protected class, precisely because they know that if you make gender identity a protected class, you would have all of these negative consequences, where gender identity is elevated as a protected class, ideology ends up winning.
Ryan, I know when you're talking some about the biology of this, what have you done any kind of research in terms of how we can think about maybe gender or sexual ambiguity when it comes to the genitalia? I know there's the intersex or hermaphrodite kind of experience people can end up having where it's a bit ambiguous. How do we think about it in those circumstances?
Sure. I mean, what sometimes is referred to as an intersex condition or hermaphrodite condition, the technical scientific medical term is a disorder of sexual development. And that technical label gets this exactly right, because ordinarily there's ordered development. And you can see ordered development would result in a male organization, a female organization. But sometimes, for a variety of reasons, there can be a disorder in development. And we have disorders in cardiac development. We refer to it as heart disease disorder, and respiratory development, refer to it as lung disease. But there can also be disorders in sexual development. This doesn't negate the sexual binary. This doesn't undermine the reality that sex is an embodied an experience. But it does say that there are some people who, because of either a chromosomal or hormonal abnormality, have a disorder in their development. But they're not a third sex. They're not somewhere in between. They're a male or a female who didn't fully develop, who has somewhere within their developmental trajectory, something went off, something went in a disordered way. And it's important for those individuals and for their families and for their doctors to be able to identify this. Frequently, disorders of sexual development need to be diagnosed shortly after birth so they can receive those patients can receive appropriate medical care. But this doesn't negate or in any way undermine sex as a concept or how we identify people sexually as male and female. And it has absolutely nothing to do with transgender identities. Frequently with transgender identities, what you have is someone who is fully developed sexually, you know, abled able-bodied, fully developed physically, but their identity doesn't align with their bodily reality.
Right. It's so helpful to talk about these things because they are so confusing. And certainly when we just maybe catch a bit of a headline or have a family experience, we can kind of define the entire issue from that. So to get into some of the complexity of this, and it is complex, I think, about all the parents listening and grandparents today. Do you have some sort of suggestions, maybe starting with if the school is teaching one thing about transgenderism and gender identity, what would you recommend for a parent or a grandparent to do to be a different kind of voice in their children's lives?
So I would say help your children understand that their biology, it's not something that was just assigned to them at birth. That language of sex assigned at birth suggests that it was arbitrarily slapped on someone, and therefore it could be reassigned later in life. Help people to realize that we're incarnate beings. We're embodied beings, and our biology isn't bigotry. We flourish the most when we live in accordance with the truth. We flourish the most when we live in accordance with reality, including the reality of our very selves, our bodily reality. And then part of this would also mean rejecting false stereotypes. A lot of people report feeling gender dysphoria because they feel like they're not living up to societal expectations of what a real man is supposed to be like or what a real woman is supposed to be like. And so what we want to do is embrace bodily reality while rejecting false cultural and societal stereotypes and expectations and norms that have nothing to do with bodily reality. And we can do those things simultaneously. We can say that you are a boy, you are a girl, but not every boy needs to like G.I. Joe. Not every girl needs to like Barbie. Frequently, the transgender ideology actually embraces these stereotypes.
Well, and Ryan, what do we risk losing if we don't hold on to some sort of gender binary here where there really is masculinity and femininity? If we just blur all of this together, is there a sense in which what we lose as a result of that?
Yeah, I mean, so the other error, right? So if one of the errors is the strict stereotypes, the other error is a culture of androgyny, a culture in which people who are advocating for equality end up reducing equality to sameness. So what's important here is to recognize that men and women are equal, but they're not the same. When you see an androgynous culture, frequently what ends up happening is that women have to live as if men. They take the male way of being human, the male body as if it's the norm, and then women are supposed to live as if their bodies are somehow sub-norm, right? And so they compete, they live, they work according to male standards. And so it's important to say that both the female way of being human and the male way of being human are equal. They're equally normal, and therefore our economy, our education system, our political system should take both ways of being human seriously and not have a bad form of androgyny in which, in actuality, it's the male body that gets privileged.
Talking with Ryan Anderson this morning, who's released the book When Harry Became Sally. Ryan, we just have about a minute left or so. If you can gaze into your crystal ball just a bit, what are the trends suggesting? Where do you see this entire thing heading here over the next 3 to 5 years?
I think for the next 3 to 5 years, it's going to be a lot more controversy, unfortunately. I don't think any of this is going to simply go away. And so I think it's going to be vitally important for people like you and me and our listeners right now to equip ourselves, to be educated, to know what's going on, to know how to talk about these issues. I think most of us would probably feel equipped to have a conversation about a controversial topic like abortion, but maybe we aren't as adept in talking to a family member or a friend or a neighbor about gender identity and gender dysphoria and transgender identities. And so it's going to be important to prepare and then also to be able to talk about these things in a loving and compassionate way. Too much of the discourse, especially over the past several years, keeps getting more and more degraded. Right? There's a lack of civility. And so we need to find a way to talk about these difficult issues in a spirit of charity.
And Brian, thanks for joining us this morning on Faith Radio Mornings. We could keep talking about this, right, for the next several hours. Incredibly important topic. But thanks for giving us just a window into a bit more of the complexity of this and empowering us to think through these issues that are so substantive in our culture today.
Yep, thank you.
We'll take a break here on Faith Radio Mornings and come back with more here next. You know, Rachel, 2018, again, one of the main topics of this past year so often that we've covered on Faith Radio Mornings have been dimensions of sexuality. We've seen such a sea change in our country, in our culture, in our churches, in our families, parenting kids over the last 5-6 years, especially with the marriage amendment becoming the law of the land that instituted same-gender marriage as a possibility moving forward. I just don't think we can talk enough about this topic given how confusing and complex and how personal it often is for people.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I feel like I've grown up in a culture that is very engaged with this subject. And so it's something we really need to learn how to talk about. And so I appreciate those voices like Ryan T. Anderson coming on and, you know, people who have actually studied this more in depth and helping us understand how to converse about this.
Yeah, I think one of the scariest things, right, is breaking open the boxes on these conversations because we just feel like, gosh, if we even say anything at all, we risk alienating everybody. And that's simply not true. It doesn't mean it's not tricky to talk about. But to your point, voices like Ryan really can help in this.
Yeah, and I do think we get scared because we live in kind of a culture that can be offended easily.
For sure.
But at the same time, I think people do value when you can talk honestly and just be down to earth about some of these subjects and say, hey, let's have a conversation respectfully with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, well said. Well, it was a great first hour here of our best of programming here for the 28th of December. We've got hour two upcoming, and we're going to start with an interview that I had with Captain Ronald Johnson a few months ago. He was the police officer that was in charge of defusing some of the Ferguson riots, and he wrote an incredible biographical story about his experience with that and what it meant for him to be appointed by the governor. He didn't even know he was going to have to step into these riots, and as an African-American man, he stepped into the midst of all of this racial turmoil, and he took off all of his protective gear and just walked down the street with the protesters. It's an incredibly moving story, so make sure to stay tuned here for our best of programming next on Faith Radio Mornings.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.